Mr. Chairman, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, it is a great honour indeed to be asked to address the Vancouver Institute, and I wish to express my pleasure at the invitation. I've spent many hours in this city reading, thinking, and writing about aspects of the Scottish Enlightenment, which has been the primary focus of my research work since coming to this university. And it is perhaps appropriate that I should give an account of my findings and views to members of this institute. I know that many of you have lively interests in Scottish matters, extending beyond the usual and natural curiosity about the ingredients of the haggis, what Scotsmen wear under the kilt, and the secret of the potency of Scotch whisky. But to understand Canadian institutions and ways, some inquiry has to be made into the Scottish element in our common background. One factor to be reckoned with is the sizable Scottish contribution to the growth of a Canadian people. This dates from the era of the Enlightenment, of which I shall be speaking. In 1973, we celebrated the arrival 200 years ago of the brig Hector, which brought 30 Highland emigrant families to Pictou County in Nova Scotia. By 1815, it is thought there were about 15,000 Scottish emigrants, Highland and Lowland, in Canada. This year, we are remembering another bicentenary, the arrival in New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, and Upper Canada of the streams of Empire loyalists, many of them Scots or of Scottish descent, seeking a peaceful home after the violent upheavals of the American Revolutionary War, and determined to hold on to their politics, but also to their religion, their moral values, and their practical bent for settling successfully in a new land. While the influence of the intellectual movement we call the Scottish Enlightenment on the leaders and rank and file of these emigrants could be exaggerated, it has to be noted that their religious drive reinforced the major Enlightenment theme of self and social improvement, and the value they placed on knowledge was of the practical kind espoused by contemporary Scottish schools and universities. Further, their bent for settling successfully in a new land had its counterpart, perhaps its model, in the struggle for survival in the face of a relatively harsh environment in the old country, more particularly the 18th and early 19th century efforts to wrest more from the soil through energetic thought as well as sweat over clearance, ditching and draining, crop management, pasturage and efficient traction. Even in recoil from Scotland, from its oppressive landlords evicting their tenants to make room for sheep, the emigrants were heartened by the ideals of the Enlightenment, embodied for them in the thought that they could make the Canadian wilderness a land of peace and freedom. A second factor that calls for attention is the nature of the institutions of social life that emerged in Canada as the first struggles of the emigrants to secure subsistence passed into the stages of consolidating and extending communities both physically and psychically. The peculiar features of Presbyterian religious life and organization surely made their influence felt. Not so much the evangelical emphases on personal conviction and emotional religious experience, but rather the moderate Presbyterian requirements of responsibility and accountability in the congregation and Kirk Session, with their lessons of keeping to rule of law, seeking community accord, but also acting on the basis of individual conscience, and the requirement of literacy to keep the system going. As for education, the schoolmasters and ministers of the emigrant societies were generally respected for their learning, could explore the treasures of literature in the Bible and somewhat the classics as well as English literature. In addition, they were conversant somewhat with the philosophy and science of their time. One specific figure of the kind I have been depicting in general terms, who had definite connections with the Scottish Enlightenment, was the Reverend Andrew Brown, son of a weaver and a graduate of Glasgow University, who served as minister in Halifax from 1787 to 1795, before returning to Scottish parishes and then the chair of rhetoric and belles lettres at Edinburgh University. A second was Thomas McCulloch, born in Scotland in 1776 and educated at Edinburgh University, who established the famous Pictou Academy in 1818. As author of the Stepshire Letters, he was one of the founders of Canadian literature, but he also modelled his curriculum on the basis of that of the Scottish universities. In general, it can be stated that the emergence of higher education in Canada owed much to the Scottish antecedents of the 18th century, perhaps even earlier if we look back to the last part of the 17th century for some of the stirrings of the Enlightenment. I choose that time, that is the 1680s, a time that was unpropitious politically for Scotland, but one that seemed to be ripe for intellectual promise for the future. In the Edinburgh lodgings of Robert Sibbald, a polymath physician of the period, a group of young doctors, fresh from completing their education on the continent, met to discuss medical and other learned subjects. From the meetings came the impetus for the foundation in 1681 of the Royal College of Physicians, which encouraged responsible medical practice and, in time, generated the professional strength which led to the creation of a famous medical school in Edinburgh, where rigorous anatomical and physiological training, together with clinical experience, was stressed in the modern manner. The initiatives of Sibbald, with his work on the pharmacopoeia and natural history, were followed up vigorously by Alexander Munro Primus, who achieved the status of public professor of anatomy in 1720 and was a leader in establishing the Edinburgh Infirmary in 1729 with a clearly defined teaching function. His scientific publications attracted attention through Europe, and he inspired students with his skill as a lecturer and dissector. Oliver Goldsmith was one of his students in the 1750s and wrote of him as follows: "This man has brought the science he teaches to as much perfection as it is capable of, and not content with barely teaching anatomy, he launches out into all the branches of physic, when all his remarks are new and useful. 'Tis he, I may venture to say, that draws together such a number of students from most parts of the world, even from Russia." It is also a representative feature of Scottish life, illustrating family tenacity, that Alexander Munro Primus was succeeded in the chair of anatomy by his son, Alexander Secundus, and he in turn by his son, Alexander Tertius, whose incumbency lasted until 1845, making 125 years of family university tenure. I don't know what the Canadian Association of University Teachers would make of this. Alas, the third Munro's professorship was not as glorious as that of his predecessors, and there is an apocryphal story that he read his grandfather's notes, delighting students of 1825 with the remark, "When I was in Leiden in 1719. More damaging to his reputation, and perhaps indicating that the Scottish Enlightenment was nearing its end, it is reported that in 1816 he was successful in thwarting an attempt to found a chair of comparative anatomy, a kind of reactionary move. Medical teaching in Canada in its origins was closely connected with the Edinburgh tradition. 2 years after the Montreal General Hospital was opened in 1822, there was created a medical institution, which was engrafted upon McGill University as its medical faculty in 1828. The first four professors were Edinburgh men, their names were not Munro, and their enterprise was described as follows: "They are further encouraged to attempt the formation of a medical seminary, when they reflect that the Medical School of Edinburgh, the basis of which they would adopt for the Montreal Institution, is now justly considered the first in Europe, though it is of comparatively recent formation, it being little more than 100 years since medical lectures were first delivered in Edinburgh. The early history of the Edinburgh Infirmary is not dissimilar to that of the Montreal General Hospital. At the same time as the seminal discussions of the 1680s among medical men in Sybil's lodgings, there were stirrings in the legal profession. The King's advocate, Sir George Mackenzie, whom readers of Scott may identify as Bloody Mackenzie because of his repression of the Covenanters, was a man of letters, and he worked hard to establish the Advocates' Library in the capital city. Its collections, through conscious policy decisions, went far beyond technical resources for the practice of Scots law and included theology, literature in many languages, philosophy, the natural and physical sciences, and above all, history. In 1709, it was included as one of the copyright libraries, with the right to request a free copy of every book registered at Stationers' Hall in London. Though this right was not always exercised, it produced an expansion of the holdings from about 5,000 books at the beginning of the 18th century to 20,000 by the 1750s, when David Hume became the library's keeper and drew widely on its resources for his History of England. I can also add that he clashed with the stuffy curators of that library over ordering racy French novels, and he ended by resigning his position. As well as his Advocates' Library initiative, Mackenzie wrote institutional works, both on civil and criminal law. And at this time of the 1680s, a greater jurist, James Dalrymple, later styled Viscount Stair, produced a legal text of the first rank with an abiding formative influence on the evolution of his country's legal thought, the institutions of the law of Scotland. Stair answers in the affirmative the question whether law may or should be handled as a rational discipline, having principles from whence its conclusions may be deduced. Stair's work was continued by other lawyers who drew on comparative sources in English common law, by Lord Kames, an object of my researches, who was interested in the empirical and psychological bases for law, Baron David Hume, who was the nephew and heir of David Hume the philosopher, wrote an institutional work on criminal law, and George Joseph Bell at the beginning of the 19th century wrote on the law commercial. One historian has noted that these books offer a copious and clear picture of a legal system represented by its commentators as a body of comprehensible substantive rules rationally related to general principles of right and supported by an adequate system of judicial remedies. In this period of the 18th century, the period of Kames and Bankton and Erskine and George Joseph Bell, there was only one English work that approached the same standard of analysis and exposition of the law, that being Blackstone's Commentaries on the Laws of England. In the Scottish universities of the same period, that is the 1680s, there was reception of the European advances in mathematics, physics, and astronomy. A key family in this activity was distinguished by the title the Mathematical Gregories. James Gregory, the most brilliant of them, did original work on optics at Aberdeen and published a description of the first reflecting telescope as a prelude to a meteoric career that took him to London, then Padua, a fellowship of the Royal Society, and occupancy of chairs of mathematics at St. Andrews in Edinburgh. He was the friend and correspondent of Newton, and this was undoubtedly responsible for the interest in Newtonian thought of his nephew and later successor in the Edinburgh chair, David Gregory, who incorporated the new physics in his lectures to his Scottish students from 1683 to 1691. He then left to become civilian professor of mathematics at Oxford. Later Gregories were not so much mathematical as medical, and I suspect that if their name is known at all in Canada, it is because of the fame among older generations of Gregory's powder, a purgative and subsequently astringent preparation of rhubarb of singular efficacy and some bitterness, administered to me by my mother when I was a boy. Specialist instruction in mathematics of the kind engaged in by the Gregorys was complemented in the early 1700s by the creation of separate chairs in Greek at the Scottish universities, and their occupants joined the professors of Latin or humanity to provide instruction in classics as the first year of university study. Then through the other universities, Edinburgh, Glasgow, later St Andrews, then at Aberdeen, the old regenting system was given over, whereby university instructors took their students through the whole three-year philosophical curriculum, logic and metaphysics in the second year, moral philosophy in the third, and natural philosophy or physics in the fourth and last year. Then separate professorships in the different subjects were established, thus permitting higher levels of teaching and research activity. This change put the Scottish universities in line with the leading continental ones, particularly those of the Netherlands, for example, Leiden, where Herman Boerhaave, who lectured on medicine and chemistry, had taught generations of pupils some of the greatest principles of medical science. It is believed that one outcome of the intellectual activity of the Enlightenment outside and inside universities was the secularization of thought. Hegel, in The Phenomenology of the Spirit, went so far as to accuse the Enlightenment of killing belief. The Scottish Enlightenment as a movement, however, found ways of accommodating religion, in particular the neo-Calvinism of the moderate Presbyterian wing of the Church of Scotland. Hence the attraction of many of the literati, as its writers called themselves, to societies such as those of the colonies of North America, where religion and churches were viewed as necessary cohesive social forces. As I shall be arguing, however, the tenor of the thought of the skeptic David Hume was far from reassuring to orthodox religious believers, or to heterodox believers in a religion of reason or nature. But all this lay in the future when universities began to be reorganized at the beginning of the 18th century. As was noticed by the sociologist Max Weber, the ideological origins of what he called the spirit of modern capitalism seem to lie in the Protestant ethical system. For Scotland, this was represented in the period I am discussing by the larger catechism, which taught the duties required by the Ten Commandments. In connection with the eighth one, which deals with excessive covetousness, Presbyterians were reminded of the following duties: a provident care and study to get, keep, use, and dispose those things which are necessary and convenient for the sustenance of our nature and suitable to our condition; a lawful calling and diligence in it; frugality, avoiding unnecessary lawsuits and suretyship or other like engagements, and an endeavour by all just and lawful means to procure, prefer, and further the wealth and outward estate of others as well as our own. Weber noted two aspects of such doctrines. First, the emphasis on the duty of diligence in one's calling, combined with frugal use of worldly goods. And second, the logical underpinning of predestination, which operated as a psychological sanction, constraining believers to a strict conformity with Calvinist ethics as the sole means by which salvation might be proved and ensured. His thesis was that this kind of Calvinism fostered the spirit of modern capitalism, with its forceful acquisitiveness associated with self-denial and self-righteousness. Weber's contention can be tested by Scottish examples. One instance is provided by the orientation and career of Sir John Clark of Pennycook, 1649 to 1722, who was an ardent Calvinist in his personal life, recording 109 covenants with his God in Christ between 1692 and 1722, through the era when I have been suggesting we see the emergence of the Scottish Enlightenment. He was also a highly successful industrial entrepreneur, conducting coal mining operations with great efficiency. It was observed that he strove with equal diligence to regenerate his miners spiritually and to generate profits for himself. His son, also John Clark — the Scots were never terribly imaginative about naming the next generation, they seemed to hand on the same names in various orders — well, the son displayed no enthusiasm for the spiritual concerns of his father, and manifested the secular and cultural improving orientation generally associated with the Enlightenment. But he also maintained the family drive for economic improvement. He was educated in law at Glasgow and Leiden, where he became the friend of the immensely learned Boerhaave, and against his father's wishes, he travelled to Italy to enjoy its painting and music and to explore Roman antiquities, a version of the grand tour of the period which was thought to complete a young man's education by showing him something of contemporary Mediterranean Europe and monuments and artifacts representing the high achievements of the classical past. On returning to Scotland, this John Clark was admitted advocate in 1700, which meant that he could plead in the highest courts of his country. Through a fortunate marriage into the family of the Duke of Queensberry, he secured the patronage leading to his appointment as one of the Scottish commissioners sent to Westminster to negotiate the Treaty of Union of 1707. This measure united the parliaments of Scotland and England and essentially produced the constitution of modern Britain. Bribery is now thought to have secured the assent of the Scottish commissioners and their country's parliament to the loss of political independence. But the episode stabilised Scottish politics, save for the Jacobite risings of 1715 and 45, and in part, the Union created the conditions necessary for intellectual achievement. John Clark's reward for his commissionership was the sinecure of a judge's seat on the newly created Scottish Court of the Exchequer. Professional work left him enough leisure to write and engage in a wide variety of scientific and cultural pursuits typical of the Scottish Enlightenment. These included mining engineering, architecture, and archaeology. About 1723, which was the year of Adam Smith's birth, and Smith's father was a friend of this Clark's, he began building a Palladian villa at Mavis Bank with the help of the Kirkcaldy contractor and architect William Adam. Other activities, such as excavating Roman villas in Midlothian, helped to give a classical tone to the aspirations and outlook of the circle he gathered for meetings at Pennycook House. His leadership in aesthetic and antiquarian matters added to the feeling of enlightened Scots that they were among the authentic heirs of Roman civilization. Sir John Clark's seventh son, also John Clark, but distinguished as John Clark of Eldon, a talented amateur artist and an influential theorist on naval tactics — they were very Catholic in their spread of interest, these enlightened Scotsmen — married into the family of this Kirkcaldy contractor Adam in 1753, and he wrote several drafts of a biographical sketch of William Adam's famous son Robert, who, together with his younger brother James, carried the family name to the heights of a European reputation for creating a distinctive style, the Adam style, in designing buildings and their interior decoration. Robert Adam's generation of the middle decades of the 18th century was the most brilliant of all those of the period of the Scottish Enlightenment. Eldon described the liberal connections of the numerous family of William Adam as follows: the uninterrupted cordiality in which they lived, their conciliating manners, and the various accomplishments in which they severally made proficience formed a most attractive society, and failed not to draw round them a set of men whose learning and genius have since done honour to that country which gave them birth. Among those mentioned by name as frequenting the family were the following: their cousin, William Robertson, the historian of Scotland, the historian of Charles V's Europe, and the historian of America, whose work inspired in Gibbon a spirit of envy and emulation. There was also John Hume, author of the romantic tragedy Douglas, set in indeterminate medieval times, which was long a favourite on the stage and among declaimers of verse. Adam Smith and David Hume, Alexander Jupiter Carlyle, the grandest demigod Walter Scott reckoned he ever saw, author of highly entertaining reminiscences of the literati of the time. One wag called them the eaterati because they were also famous connoisseurs of food. And there was also Alexander Wedderburn, the lawyer who founded the first Edinburgh Review and became the first Scottish Chancellor of Great Britain. William Falconer, whose poem The Shipwreck, 1762, drew on his experiences as a sailor in the Levant and provided the first modern description of Greece, which probably inspired Byron with his love of Greece and longing to visit there. The geologist James Hutton, whose theory of Earth of 1788 developed ideas about the Earth's formation and transformation in a cyclical fashion arising from the effects of heat, an object of Scottish scientific inquiry and experimentation through this era. And Adam Ferguson, sometime Black Watch chaplain and author of A History of Civil Society of 1767, a pioneering work in sociology which had attracted the attention in the next century of Karl Marx. An anecdote recorded by Jupiter Carlyle indicates something of the tension in the society caused by the advanced philosophical viewpoint of David Hume. In the 1750s, he had achieved notoriety and had been identified as the atheist, a reputation which was not unknown to Mrs. Adam, the mother of Robert Adam, the architect. But as matters turned out, this proved less formidable than his evident, that is, Hume's evident good nature. Jupiter Carlyle reported thus: "When Mr. Robert Adam, the celebrated architect, and his brother James lived in Edinburgh with their mother, an aunt of Dr. Robertson's and a very respectable woman, she said to her son, 'I shall be glad to see any of your companions to dinner, but I hope you will never bring the atheist here to disturb my peace.' But Robert soon fell on a method to reconcile her to him, for he introduced Hume under another name or concealed it carefully from her. When the company parted, she said to her son, 'I must confess that you bring very agreeable companions about you, but the large, jolly man who sat next to me is the most agreeable of them all.' 'This was the very atheist,' said he, 'mother, that you was so much afraid of.' 'Well,' says she, 'you may bring him here as much as you please, for he's the most innocent, agreeable, facetious man I ever met with.'" Carlyle shared Mrs. Adams' opinion of Hume, and the passage from which I quoted continues, "Though Hume had much learning and a fine taste, and was professedly a skeptic, though by no means an atheist, he had the greatest simplicity of mind and manners, with the utmost facility and benevolence of temper of any man I ever knew. His conversation was truly irresistible, for while it was enlightened, it was naive almost to puerility." There is a story that Hume was crossing the Firth of Forth during a storm, and his companion, a very vivacious lady, Lady Wallace, began to be frightened, and Hume started to talk about them being food for the fishes, which made her even more frightened, at which point he said, and he was always very conscious of his height and corpulence, that he would be food for the gluttons, and he was sure that Lady Wallace would be food for the epicures. Born the younger son of a border laird, Hume was the grandson on the mother's side of a president of the Court of Session, that is, the Supreme Civil Court of Scotland. Between 1723 and 1725, he attended Edinburgh University, which had benefited from the curricular reforms I have already described. There he had a stimulating exposure to the new philosophy of Newton and Locke, and had his interest aroused in rhetoric, criticism, and history. He began private studies, ostensibly for a career in law, but this appeared nauseous to him, and he decided there was no other way of pushing his fortune but that of a scholar and philosopher. This was the era of which the anecdotalist Ramsay of Ochtertyre wrote. It is well known that between 1723 and 1740, nothing was more in request with the Edinburgh literati, clerical and laical, than metaphysical disquisitions. These they regarded as more pleasant themes than either theological or political controversies, of which by that time people were surfeited. One forum for this philosophical discussion in Edinburgh was the Rankinian Club, organised about 1716 by certain university professors and students in law and divinity. The club carried on a literary correspondence with Bishop Berkeley, pushing hard his amazing tenets, such as to be is to be perceived. He is said to have been greatly pleased with the extraordinary acuteness and peculiar ingenuity displayed by the members of this club, and declared no persons understood his system better than this set of young gentlemen in North Britain. This was the philosophical atmosphere in which Hume was nurtured. While he felt his reading only uncovered endless disputes in the fundamental articles of philosophy and criticism, a certain boldness of temper, as he put it himself, led him to reject authority in these subjects and seek out some new medium by which truth might be established. At 18, apparently, after much study and reflection, there opened up to him a new scene of thought which transported me without measure. His intellectual efforts of the next few years included sceptical reflection, which led to the loss of religious faith. This he described in a letter written in 1751, explaining the origins of his dialogues concerning natural religion. "'Tis not long ago that I burned an old manuscript book, wrote before I was 20, which contained, page after page, the gradual progress of my thoughts on that head, that is, belief in a deity. It began with an anxious search after arguments to confirm the common opinion. Doubts stole in, dissipated, returned, were again dissipated, returned again, and it was a perpetual struggle of a restless imagination against inclination, perhaps against reason." So intense were Hume's intellectual struggles at this period that they brought him to the verge of a nervous breakdown, which he described in a letter to a London physician of 1734. In that year, he left his home at Nine Wells in Berwickshire, made a brief trial of a merchant's life at Bristol, and then went to France, latterly to La Flèche in Anjou, to find for 3 years the tranquility needed to write a treatise of human nature, which he hoped would effect a Copernican revolution in the science of man. The clue to identifying the new scene of thought Hume referred to surely lies, at least in part, in the subtitle to the treatise, being an attempt to introduce the experimental method of reasoning into moral subjects. Hume is taking up Newton's challenge that moral philosophy would be advanced as much as science if the inductive method were adopted. It also appears from his procedure in the treatise that he was impressed by the attention given by contemporaries to the emotional basis for human judgments and actions. The moral subjects Hume instances to be tackled by the inductive method and acknowledgement of man's irrational side are logic, morals, that is, ethics, criticism, and politics. Accordingly, he published at London in 1739, in one volume, the first two books of the treatise, one, Of the Understanding, dealing with the origin and nature of our ideas, and two, Of the Passions, dealing with our psychological mechanisms. An advertisement to this volume stated that the author would proceed to morals, politics, and criticism, which will complete this treatise of human nature if the public approved his efforts. Book 3 of Morals was in fact published in 1740, but relative neglect and outright hostility had met Hume's work, and he gave up in despair his first attempt to change radically knowledge of human nature. His program, however, was carried out to some extent by other members of the circle of literati in Scotland, including attention to criticism or literary criticism. And it always astonishes my friends in the English department when I claim that one of the sources of our discipline was the teaching of rhetoric and literary criticism by Adam Smith in the Scotland of the 1750s. First readers of the treatise were not ready for a relentlessly skeptical critique of metaphysics and empiricism, whereby man is revealed as a being dominated by emotion and appetite, custom and belief. The key argument concerning causation was misunderstood, namely, that there is no logical basis for insisting on a necessary connection between cause and effect. Hume argues that this relationship is discovered after the fact, and therefore not abstract reason but custom is the guide to life. Also misunderstood was the polemical climax of Book Two. Reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passions, and can never pretend to any other office than to serve and obey them. In addition, the ethical naturalism of Book Three was regarded as an offensive doctrine. One outraged critic, William Wishart Secundus, principal of Edinburgh University, saw Hume, and I quote, sapping the foundations of morality by denying the natural and essential difference betwixt right and wrong, good and evil, justice and injustice, making the differences only artificial and to arise from conventions and compacts. Finally, the style and tone of the treatise, abstruse and deeply personal turnabout, irritated some readers, and in time, the author himself, who felt he had made a spectacle of his intellectual nakedness. I was carried away by the heat of youth and invention to publish too precipitately, he wrote to a friend in 1751. So vast an undertaking, planned before I was 21 and composed before 25, must necessarily be very defective. I have repented my haste 100 and 100 times. Learning his rhetorical and stylistic lessons, Hume recast his thought without giving up his philosophical principles, first in the form of essays, moral and political, and then in inquiries. The inquiry concerning human understanding of 1748, which is the best introduction to Hume's thinking, presenting in a polished style his central concern with the limits of human knowledge, and the role of mitigated skepticism in reconciling reason with experience. There was also the recasting of the third book of the treatise as an inquiry concerning the principle of morals, published in 1751. The stress here is on the role of feeling in connection with forming and acting upon moral judgments. And Hume argues that the principles of justice are respected and enforced on the basis of utility. He thought it incomparably the best of his writings, but noted dryly in his brief autobiography that the book came unnoticed and unobserved into the world. Not so the political discourses of 1752, which carried out something of the programme of analysis of politics anticipated in the preface to the treatise. This was immediately popular on its appearance and was translated into French twice within 2 years. In these discourses, among other subjects, Hume attacked the chief dogmas of mercantilism, the economic philosophy which held that a country's wealth could be promoted by protectionist policies and control of specie, that is, money in the form of coins. Hume argued that wealth lay in commodity exchange and that free trade stimulated growth in every participating country. These insights into economic life and the outcome of specific policy advice prepared the way for the systematic analysis of Adam Smith's inquiry into the nature and causes of the wealth of nations, published in 1776, this being a characteristic work of the Scottish Enlightenment and a foundation document in the field of economics. But we have to note that in the Literary Society of Glasgow as early as 1752, Adam Smith is reported reading an account of some of Mr. David Hume's essays on commerce. So the Humean ideas were being presented well before the appearance of the Wealth of Nations. The intellectual thrust of Hume's secular and sceptical inquiries into individual human nature, social behaviour, values, institutions, and the distinctions and achievements of humanity through the adoption or modification of and principled resistance to his insights all advanced the development of what we now call the social sciences, to which the Scottish Enlightenment made so notable a contribution. Demography, economics, as we have seen, political science, anthropology, particularly that of religion, adumbrated in Hume's Natural History of Religion, and sociology in the form of analysis of the configurations of civil society. Perhaps from reading the Socratic dialogues, you will recall that Meno once in jest likened Socrates' effect on others to the numbness of the electric shock inflicted by the flat stingray of the Mediterranean. Put another way, this suggests that Socratic doubt numbed the lips and minds of a mind of a recipient. The inexorable rationalism that forced awareness of ignorance about the true, the good, or the beautiful, or whatever, as a prelude to acceptance of the Socratic definition of the real. As the title of my talk suggests, I conceive of Hume in a different light, as an intellectual gadfly stirring up his countrymen, energizing them, animating them to display their mental agility and maneuverability, in short, forever encouraging reaction and progressive redefinition of problematic matters. In 1751, after personal vicissitudes that included failure to get a chair at Edinburgh and then Glasgow, a period as tutor to a mildly lunatic peer, military service in a botched commando raid on France, and diplomatic service in Austria and Italy, Hume settled in Edinburgh, holding from 1752 until 1757 the post of Keeper of the Advocate's Library, to which I've already referred. This gave him the opportunity to write his History of England. In this work and other historical writings, he elaborated a dynamic view of history in which human needs are portrayed as driving men into more complex relations with each other, thus encouraging the division of labor and so the development of an increasing range of skills or arts. In the political discourses, Hume identifies the stages of development society passes through in terms of the characteristic economic order, fishing and hunting, pastoralism, agriculture and commerce. His basic argument runs that in certain respects the heights of human achievement can be attained in a commercial society where civil virtues are allowed to flourish, hence the case for the encouragement of trade nationally and internationally. Elsewhere, he tends to minimize economic causation and to emphasize the cultural and political factors that bring about historical change in a cyclical fashion. In the History of England, for example, noting the gradual relapse into ignorance and barbarism from the time of Augustus Caesar to a low point in the 11th century, and then the reascent of the son of science to the period of the revival of letters in the 15th century, the time of the Renaissance, as we call it. The literati of the Scottish Enlightenment took up these ideas of insights of Hume, added to them, modified them, or sought to challenge and refute them. Henry Hume, an older cousin of David's, who had sufficient standing as an advocate to encourage the younger man at the outset of his career, published in 1747 a book called Essays Upon Several Subjects Concerning British Antiquities, a dry-as-dust title, certainly, but one covering inquiries into the skeptical spirit of David Hume into the origins of property and government, with the very practical purpose of attacking the ideology of the Jacobites, whose last rising had failed the year previous to publication. David Hume praised Henry Hume's essays, adding slyly, "You do me the honour to borrow some principles from a certain book," that is, the treatise. "I wish they be not esteemed too subtle and abstruse." Henry was raised to the bench as Lord Kames in 1751 and had a distinguished career as jurist, land improver and man of letters. Boswell thought of writing his life, and he recorded an account of Kames's efforts to understand Hume's treatise. First efforts, even with David's tutoring, were unavailing, but one May morning, Kames got up at 6 o'clock, found nothing to do in the fields — he was an amateur farmer — and so he took up the treatise, understood it, and wrote observations on it, subsequently taking the form of objections. These were published in the form of essays on the principles of morality and natural religion. Essentially, Keynes argues that the answer to the new way of ideas of Descartes, Locke, and Berkeley, taken to skeptical conclusions by David Hume, was to rely on the promptings of common sense about an integrated self and the epistemologically and morally sound universe with which the self has dealings. Here are the seeds of the common sense philosophy, which was the staple of the Scottish Enlightenment, developed more profoundly by Thomas Reid and the Aberdeen School. Reid acknowledged Hume's prompting in this regard and wrote him a letter from which I will quote. "Your friendly adversaries, Drs. Campbell and Gerard, as well as Dr. Gregory, return their compliments to you respectfully. A little philosophical society here," that is in Aberdeen, the Wise Club as it was called, "of which all three are members, is much indebted to you for its entertainment. Your company would, though we are all good Christians, be more acceptable than that of St. Anastasius. And since we cannot have you upon the bench, you are brought oftener than any other man to the bar, accused and defended with great zeal, but without bitterness. If you write no more on morals, politics, or metaphysics, I am afraid we shall be at loss for subjects." The Scottish common sense philosophy accorded well with the tenets of Presbyterianism, and through the strength of its adherents in the New World, this philosophy was acceptable in their colleges and seminaries, and was diffused through North American society by their graduates. An example lies to hand in the institution that became Princeton University. On the death of its president, Jonathan Edwards, a successor was found in John Witherspoon, minister of Paisley, a leader of the evangelical wing, nicknamed the High Flyers of the Kirk in Scotland. He proved a masterful president, reforming the curriculum along the lines of his alma mater, Edinburgh University, and he taught with success the Scottish common sense philosophy. He also taught rhetoric and principles of composition, according to the style of Adam Smith, we think. The University of Pennsylvania, at nearby Philadelphia, also used Thomas Reid and the other common sense philosophers as philosophical authorities, and had their students work through the common sense refutations of Hume's skepticism. In Canada, at Pictou Academy, and through the 19th century, the teaching of philosophy in Canada was strongly influenced by upholders of Scottish traditions in this discipline. That very interesting recent book on philosophy and culture in English Canada from 1850 to 1950, The Faces of Reason by Leslie Armour and Elizabeth Trott, has called some of them to our attention. They include William Lyle, who taught at Knox College, Toronto, and then at the Free Church College in Halifax. He was a pupil of Thomas Brown, the common sense philosopher at Edinburgh University, and Lyle's treatise on intellect, the emotions, and the moral nature, published in 1855, probes deeply philosophical themes attended to throughout the Scottish Enlightenment and sharply focused in Hume's treatise, with its separate parts assigned to the understanding, the passions, and morals. Lyle was succeeded at Knox College by George Paxton Young, who had studied Sir William Hamilton's philosophy at Edinburgh, but fell under the spell of Hegel and electrified his students at Toronto, latterly at the Secular University College, with a variant of idealism until the 1880s. At McGill, James Clerk Murray, another product of Edinburgh University, advanced until his death in 1917, a social philosophy which sought to combat the corruption of a commercial and industrial age in a manner reminiscent of Adam Ferguson's stand in the History of Civil Society of 1767. Queen's University, a veritable stronghold of Presbyterianism, was the setting for the career of James Watson, another neo-Hegelian, but from Glasgow University, who worked on the interplay of reason and experience in politics, another Scottish Enlightenment theme. As I have suggested, however, none of these thinkers stood pat on common sense formulations, but were receptive to the advances in philosophy, if they were advances, associated with the names of Kant and Hegel. Still, we do learn that they felt they had to combat the insidious attack on reason of skepticism. Just as neo-Hegelianism in Britain had to express itself in T.H. Green's lengthy polemic against Hume in his introduction to what is still the standard edition of Hume's works, so George Paxton Young, from first to last, opposed the philosophical views of Hume. Le Bon David was ever the gadfly, it appears, among yesterday's philosophers of Canada, as well as among his Scottish contemporaries. Why should this be so? I submit there are two reasons. The first is that Hume speaks with the voice of an intelligence that is undeceived by illusions, unprejudiced, unflinching, as in that last edition to the Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, perhaps written on his deathbed in 1776, in which he calls on us to survey nature as it really appears, not as speculative metaphysicians would have it, or empirical theists. Look round this universe. What an immense profusion of beings, animated and organized, sensible and active. You admire this prodigious variety and fecundity, but inspect a little more narrowly these living existences, the only beings worth regarding. How hostile and destructive to each other. How insufficient all of them for their own happiness. How contemptible or odious to the spectator. The whole presents nothing but the idea of a blind nature, impregnated by a great vivifying principle, and pouring forth from her lap, without discernment or parental care, her maimed and abortive children. This is painful, disturbing, shocking, destabilizing, not at all enlightenment as we generally understand it. But Hume is the memorable gadfly for another reason. In the face of such a clear-eyed vision of the world we live in, he stings us with recognition of the resources of our humanity, permitting us to survive, grow, perhaps even to flourish. As he puts it at the conclusion of his essay on the idea of a perfect commonwealth, I allow the justice of the poet's exclamation on the endless projects of the human race, man, which also means woman, and forever. Thank you.
Professor Ross will answer any questions that you may have if you direct them directly to him. If you'd repeat the question.
Yes. Yes.
I was interested in your mentioning that among the United Empire loyalists who left the United States for Canada, there are quite a number of Scots.
Yes.
To what extent do you believe that this was a factor, an increase in the number of Scots who came to Canada, and
The question concerns the Empire Loyalists who moved from the United States as it had become to Canada 200 years ago, and the extent to which subsequent emigrants would come to Canada rather than to Scotland. I really haven't studied the patterns of emigration, but I do know enough about the family contacts to know that it's very likely that they were sustained through the period of Scots being in America, that is, United States, and then would continue in that latter period, and the Scots would feel that coming to Canada, they would be within a country where the institutions were familiar. So I think that's a reasonable conjecture about a pattern of emigration. Well, I'm referring to a famous passage in the treatise in which he talks about billiard balls hitting each other. And the notion is that antecedent to perceiving the billiard balls colliding, we wouldn't know what was to happen, what would be cause and what would be effect. It's after, when we have experience empirically, that we can start to look at cause and effect and reason that subsequently there will be a pattern of cause-effect relationship. But people had felt up to this time, or had argued, that there was some kind of force in causation driving the effect out of the cause, as it were. And he thought that was a metaphysical fiction. Yes, essentially it was rejecting a theological or supernatural explanation. You mean prior to the Heights of Abraham and prior to, yes. Yes. Undoubtedly. There were Scots in Cape Breton, of course, but there were Scots in Quebec, some of them with Jacobite allegiance, and some of them who had turned to the service of France because at home, politically, they were out of favor. So they tended to follow the French king's fortunes because of political faith. But again, I can't give you a number, but I do know about that feature of the history of Canada. Yes. Yes?
The Scottish nationalist movement doesn't seem to be getting any headlines these days. Do you have any insight as to what is happening now, and is there any way that Mike Trump has had any
Well, the Enlightenment itself was a cosmopolitan movement, and though the Scots enlightened figures were proud of being Scots, they also wanted to think of themselves as North Britain. One subject that I wanted to talk about and would like to talk about in a way, though it should be illustrated, is the development of the Edinburgh New Town, which incorporated some of the ideals of the Enlightenment and enlightened Scotland. And that was a plan that unfolded from about 1767, whereby squares and a series of streets on a grid pattern were established. And one square was St. George's Square, and another square was St. Andrew's Square. And this was to symbolize the Union. Now, I argued or mentioned that the Union arose from bribery and corruption, but in the end, through the 18th century, many Scots accepted it as a wise measure for the security of their country politically and for some economic hope for their country. So the 18th century point of view tended to be acceptance of the Union. Now, in recent years, there's been disenchantment with the Union, and particularly when oil was discovered in the North Sea, and there was some thought that Scotland was being deprived economically because of the control from Westminster, the fortunes of the Scottish Nationalist Party rose. But as you know, the measure for devolution didn't get an absolute endorsement, and the Conservatives came in, and it's been set aside, I think. Sorry, yes?
How was the Scottish Enlightenment different from the French Enlightenment?
Well, one difference, I think, would be a stress within the French Enlightenment on atheism. Hume was scandalized by the dogmatism of the atheists in the D'Holbach circle in Paris. He thought they were just as dogmatic as the Calvinists that he encountered in Scotland. Whereas the enlightened Scots, the larger group that is beyond Hume, tended to be moderate Presbyterianism, still accepting some degree of religion, a kind of religion of nature or religion of reason, perhaps. So they were different from many of the leading French figures. But again, there were links with France, and Hume was widely admired in France.
Is that because Presbyterianism
is
more reasonable?
Well, moderate Presbyterianism was more. The high flyers were not very reasonable.
the Scots down in Cape Breton
yes.
seem to be mostly Roman Catholic.
Ah, yes. They would be emigrants from the Highland areas who had retained the older faith, yes. That's true, yes. But, you know, their educational institutions would still be affected, I think, by some of the Enlightenment ideas, even though they had retained the Catholic faith. Then they retained the Gaelic language, of course.
Hume did a great deal in assisting Rousseau.
Yes.
Yes. Do you remember what was the cause of their subsequent dispute?
Oh, yes. I could talk a little bit about that. Hume befriended Rousseau in France, where he was, to some degree, suffering from persecution. And Hume persuaded Rousseau to come to England, and he persuaded George III to give Rousseau a pension, which I think is very liberal of George III. I think he gets a bad press, it seems to me, but in this instance, he seemed very liberal. He also gave Dr. Johnson a pension, George III did. Anyway, Hume brought Rousseau to England and found a refuge for him in Derbyshire. And then Rousseau was left somewhat on his own. I don't think there were many French speakers, if any, around him. And he suffered from some degree of, paranoid fears and alarms. And he began to feel that Hume was an enemy, that Hume had carried him away to England to silence him. And he came to feel that Hume was evil. And so Rousseau ran away from his refuge. So it's really an example of paranoid behavior. It's interesting that the confessions of Rousseau stop short of giving any account of that incident.
What is the Edinburgh Review an outcome of the Scottish Enlightenment?
Well, I think it's very much an outcome. There was the first one of the 1750s failed. Adam Smith wrote for it and some other interesting people, but it didn't achieve any degree of circulation. And then in the early 19th century, the circle of Francis Jeffreys and Lord Broom, or the man who became Lord Broom, and Sidney Smith, all of whom were students of Dugald Stewart, the great common sense philosopher of that period, they became the critics of literature and the critics of political economy and so on. They had a range of intellectual interests that allowed them to review a wide range of books and take on a wide range of issues. So I see them as the heirs of the leading figures of the Scottish Enlightenment. Walter Scott, too, who is associated with the other Quarterly Review, his viewpoint on history seems to me and to other commentators to be arising from the Enlightenment. We sometimes think of him as a romantic figure, but Waverley and other novels are dealing with issues about the passing of an old order and hanging on to it when it's no longer viable and how you have to accept a new order, which is a kind of Enlightenment argument. Yes? Yes. Reed... The question was about the origins of the Scottish common sense philosophies. One origin was the reaction of Lord Kames to Hume's scepticism, feeling that it was destabilizing in terms of holding on to a stable notion of the self and a stable notion of the external world and so on. And so Kames developed this notion that through common sense, we had promptings, intuitions, that allowed us to say we have a self that survives all our experience, and so on. That was one origin. Somewhat contemporaneously, Thomas Reid was elaborating something of the same argument, but with greater philosophical subtlety. Does that answer your question? Beattie was swept up, into the Dr. Johnson circle, and I fear he acquired some of the habits of trying to argue people down and so on that were associated with that group. and he was very obnoxious in his attack on Hume. Hume called him that silly, bigoted fellow Beattie, the only indication of petulance, I think, on Hume's part that I could instance for you. But Beattie's essay on truth is a kind of polemic against skepticism. Philosophically, it's not a very sophisticated document. And it comes after Lord Kames and Thomas Reed's inquiry and Oswald, I think. It's rather late in the history of common sense philosophy.
You don't think that's the main influence in the United States?
Beattie? Yes. Well, certainly his essay on truth was read, but also Dugald Stewart's books were read, and Reed. You'll find these books listed in the Princeton philosophy curriculum of the later 18th century, for example, and at the University of Pennsylvania. I think there was more heat than light in Beattie, and so probably he made a certain impact, but the longer lasting influences, I think, would be Reed and Dugald Stewart. Yes, yes.
You spoke well about the transmission of human thought through others in Scotland and this continent. What about the transmission of his thought through Immanuel Kant in Germany?
Yes. The question is, how was Hume's thought transmitted to Immanuel Kant at Königsberg? And the answer that's often given is that Kant was awakened from his dogmatic slumbers by reading a passage of Hume embedded in Beattie's Essay on Truth, and it startled him so much that he woke up. Now, some think that he went to sleep after that. I don't know. But it's not thought that Kant read through all of... maybe some others could... Maybe Peter Remnant could answer more specifically that point, but... My reading suggests that Kant was not a profound student of a range of writings by Hume. He was working out his own philosophy and got a prompting through something he read in Beattie. Peter, is that... that biographically, that is...
I used to know the details of
yeah. I've been somewhat alarmed seeing Peter Remnant in my audience... A professional philosopher with his collar and tie on. I usually don't see him with his collar and tie. Yes.
You suggested that in Canada, the Scots of Kames found Hume something of a threat.
Yes.
Was this actually distant, or were there Scots here actually pushing Hume's ideas as well?
I don't know of any. What would we say, that disciples of Hume. But I do know, it's reported that when George Paxton Young lectured, Hume was an object of his philosophical attacks because he felt he had to deal with skepticism if the case for idealism was to be made. And it's very interesting that, you know, he's doing this as a neo-Hegelian, and in Britain of the same time, that is through the 1870s and so on, the neo-Hegelians in Britain also felt that they had to scot Hume, you know, to put him down.
Well, I was wondering, with the fact that no one in Scotland seemed to be pushing Hume's ideas,
yes.
Would that suggest that perhaps there was an unconscious acceptance of him,
Well, I think just that his arguments are far-reaching and powerful, and people who reason philosophically come up against them, and if they pursue the path of idealism, they have to deal with this, the skeptical thrust, and so they have to take on these arguments about causation and so on. James Watson, one figure that I mentioned at Queen's, apparently the last thing he was writing, he died in 1939, was a book on rational religion, which is the object of Hume's skeptical attack in the dialogues concerning natural religion. So Watson is still working over this problem.
You listed a number of people contemporaneous with that.
Yes.
Who were the great men of this Enlightenment.
Yes.
How many were there in the deteriorating?
Well, I mean, I could mention some. The question is, who were the other figures in the Scottish Enlightenment group contemporaneous with Hume? Hume's principal friend was Adam Smith, and the person closest to him philosophically, in a way, was Smith. One commentator on Smith wrote that he was infected by Hume's society, and progressively Smith got more skeptical as he got older. That doesn't often happen, you know. We often go the other way around, I think. Anyway, it happened to Smith. So Adam Smith, one of the foremost common sense philosophers was Thomas Reid, that is R-E-I-D, Thomas Reid, a historian who followed on Hume's work and really wrote a kind of philosophical history with an economic analysis, was William Robertson. He wrote A History of America. This man, Andrew Brown, whom I dug up, who was a minister at Halifax, has an unpublished history of the Americas. I don't know anything about it. Anyway, going back to the circle around Hume, there was William Robertson. On the side of law and philosophy, common sense philosophy, there was Lord Kames, that is K-A-M-E-S, an older man than Hume and something of a patron of Hume in the early days. Yes, he was a cousin. On the scientific side, and I didn't mention too many of the scientific people, except, say, the medical Monroes, for example, and the Gregories, the leading scientist, I think, of the Scottish Enlightenment was Joseph Black, who discovered the principle of latent heat. The Scots scientists were very interested in the effects, chemical and physical, of heat, and Joseph Black worked on this problem. Another medical scientist interested in things like soil chemistry. The Scottish scientists were often very practical and were seeking to make discoveries that could be applied to the improving of agriculture and so on. Another person along that line was William Cullen, C-U-L-L-E-N. I could give you a reading list if you were interested.
Ladies and gentlemen, to express your gratitude to Professor Ross, I would ask Peter Remnant to do that with his tie on.
Thank you very much, Chairman. It's a great pleasure to thank Ian Ross for his exclamation. I stole that from the Dean of Arts, to whom I'm going to return it immediately. When I was a graduate student in the middle of the century, in the middle of the 20th century, Hume was the only four-letter word that was acceptable in respectable analytical circles. Philosophers have now become more permissive, but David Hume continues to be one of the recognized fathers of the modern movement in philosophy. But unfortunately, the Hume of the philosophers is a very abstract creature identified by a number of well-known arguments and by several slim volumes, who might just as well have lived in London or Paris or Berlin. Professor Ross has returned Hume to the galaxy of stars who shone so brilliantly in Edinburgh in the 1750s, 1760s, 1770s, in the Calvinist darkness of that city at that time. We are most indebted to him.